Hello and welcome back to Aravis Presents, a podcast where we aim to speak to figures within the asset management world about the markets, what moves them, and where they might be headed next. My name is Hugo Rogers, Associate Director at Aravis Capital. If you enjoy our podcast, please do subscribe, tell a friend, or leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Today, I'm pleased to announce we're joined by a familiar friend of the podcast, Stephen Luck. Stephen is the CEO at Chinese investment boutique FountainCap Research and Investment, based out of Hong Kong. While US markets have been buoyed by their tech champions in the last 12 months, China's former giants continue to act as a drag on theirs. Today, we take a closer look at big tech in China, its origins, and often volatile relationship with government. We also address the derating of the former leading companies, which sectors might drive tomorrow's winners, and the puzzle of implementing AI with Chinese characteristics. Stephen Luck, welcome back. Always fantastic to speak to you, get your insights. How's everything in Hong Kong?
All's well, Hugo. Good to be here again. Thanks for the invite to share thoughts and just have a good chat.
Absolutely. So I think with big tech, it's probably important to kind of define the question somewhat. This is going to be quite a broad ranging conversation about, you know, the big tech companies in China. So I think the best place to start is firstly, what have been the dominant big tech players? Has that changed? What are the new kind of set of competitors look like?
Yes. So, I mean, to really talk about this, I think you're going to have to look at the almost at the turn of the century when, you know, there's this big push from China to increase connectivity, to catch up with the Western world. You know, by the year 2000, the Western world is already fairly well connected to the internet, whereas in China, that just wasn't the case. And there's just been a big push from the telecom providers to make sure that the infrastructure is in place, all the way to obviously this applications of players that started to bud. That's when you start seeing the rise of obviously the likes of Tencent, Baba, NetEase, you know, even earlier days of Sina, and a bunch of other players that are no longer around. So that has been the drivers in terms of the evolution of the tech space in China over the past two decades. And at the heart of it, in my opinion, all hinges upon this idea of connectivity, just bringing people from offline to online and shifting and digitalizing essentially the lifestyle. You know, the super app of Tencent does this best. And then you have all these other proliferation of similar players that try to do the same thing. And we see, you know, the car hailing scene evolve into bicycles hailing in that, and that spawned a bunch of other stuff. And then the social media players also spawned. But all of these are essentially still playing the same theme, which is about connectivity. Now, that phase, in my opinion, is very much over. You know, in penetration of smartphones, penetration of just even the Tencent app itself, or WeChat, to be precise, is very highly penetrated. Yes, you know, you can look at the figures and say you can argue that still about 200, maybe 300 million people that are not using it. But frankly speaking, I feel like these will always be that group of people that are just not going to be fully adapting to the technology. So in my opinion, this mega driver of tech over the past 20 years, this idea of connecting people, at least in China, it has plateaued. So going forward, then the idea is what will really be driving, you know, innovation, or what would be the big push that tech, or the big problem that tech is trying to solve. Now we see in the, if you follow this line of thinking and you're trying to look into the Western world, this is the rise of AI. This is where AI starts to become, you know, the next big theme, the next big talked about, you know, idea. And look at NVIDIA is going crazy at the moment. And I am a believer that AI is here to disrupt our life. It will be the next big thing, and we're still trying to figure out how best to integrate that into our life. However, if you look at China, here I do think is where that you're going to start to see a significant divergence. And this is a theme where, you know, I think I have talked a lot about over the past few years with our investors. When we're on the road, I talk a lot about this as well, how just this new phase of evolution in tech within China is not going to be the same. And I mean, we can dive into it to exactly why that is, but ultimately, I think it really just comes down to this idea of control, which really fits more into the governing system of the country. And that's a huge topic that we can, you know, we can go on forever about this. But at the heart of it, I do think what drove China in terms of innovation, in terms of you know, within the technology space, is no longer going to be, perhaps even in the future, maybe it will be actually driven by the government, by Beijing. But that's where the problem starts.
Yeah, so many threads I want to pull on there, and we'll come back to the AI piece. I think it's obviously really interesting, but I want to move on to that later. For now, I want to stick on kind of the major players and how this space developed. And I think it's impossible to talk about China big tech without referencing the US. You know, we think of big tech, we think of the US, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, and a few others these days. My view on that is that we've discussed ourselves about the idea that the USA innovates, China replicates. But I would argue that the origins of the large technology companies, the inverse was true for quite a long time, especially in the early noughties. And it's almost like looking at the development of the US tech space on 1.5 speed, listening speed, because it was just accelerating so quickly. So I look at the kind of various areas. I think mobile payments, and we can maybe talk about that briefly, was really really started the momentum for a lot of these big companies, particularly Tencent and Baba. If you maybe talk about that a bit, because that was well ahead of the United States on something like mobile payments.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you go to China today, it's basically a cashless society. We recently took a few of our existing investors into China, and you know, they were just basically shocked of how reliant you have to be to use your smartphones in everything that you do, from simple things as even ordering menus in restaurants. You must use your smartphones. So, you know, this, but again, so this is really, in my opinion, sort of the, like you said, where China accelerated when it compares to the West. And there are a number of other tech where this is happening as well. You look at telecommunication infrastructure. You know, the rest of the world was still operating under 4G, LTE technology. China was already light speed ahead with 5G rollout. In fact, China has the most 5G coverage in the whole world. And it is already leading in 6G technology that it is developing at the moment. So there are, I mean, China, I do agree that, you know, the West innovates and China replicates. But then once that technology falls into the hands of the Chinese, they really run with this and create something that the Western world probably wouldn't have been able to do. And now you almost have this reversal taking place, where because China is so far ahead, 1.5 times, as you just mentioned, where you almost start to see that the Western companies are trying to catch up, are trying to replicate what the Chinese did. You know, Tencent, the WeChat app, is the perfect example. I mean, this is a super app, and it's been years where I think the Western companies, social media companies, that's been trying to create something similar, but they just haven't been able to. Now, I mean, obviously the dynamics are very different, you know, in the West and also in China, when it comes to, you know, control, first mover advantage, and again, you know, given the governance system too, it makes it very hard to have that kind of monopoly control over any particular industry. But nonetheless, I mean, you definitely see this tech race no longer just U.S. innovating and China replicating. I think China is also leading in a couple of areas, increasingly so, where the Western world is trying to catch up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the example that most people use about the super app, which is Tencent, we've heard Elon Musk in the last, 6 months, talk about the idea he wants to turn X into a super app. And it's long been lauded, the idea that you can create these super apps and bundle your users and get them using all your services within a single application. I guess you capture all the revenues from those activities. That said, I do think that actually Apple took the Tencent playbook and they did it without doing an app. They just did it within the ecosystem. It's the same model, effectively, to my eyes anyway. They have, you know, iCloud, they have Apple Pay within that, all your data, all your storage, they have your phone usage, your computer usage, your iPad usage. So I think actually there was replication there. It maybe just didn't look like a one-to-one copy, but I certainly think they were inspired by that model of taking this huge ingrained audience and making sure that they were as sticky as possible within the kind of suite of products. I wanted to keep on the idea of the replication, the innovation. Some of the other areas I think are really interesting that we've seen replication, or certainly have become popular in China and then moved to the West, like short form video. I think that probably has its origins in China, where it wasn't big until 2019, 20. But that was started in China, right? That kind of whole trend, very popular.
Correct. Absolutely. So, you know, the rise of ByteDance, which actually has two sub apps. You have the TikTok, and then the equivalent of that in within China is Douyin. You know, funny fact, you know, TikTok, the app itself is actually banned in China. You can't even use that app. So, anyway, that's a whole different story. And then you because of that, you have this also rise of the other social media platforms like Kuaishou, and then you have the Bilibili, and you know, all of these short form video, where over the past few years, you see Western companies like Meta investing heavily within the space. You see YouTube is also actually investing heavily in this space, trying to also replicate this short form video. But you're right. I mean, this originated in China.
So he's a product of the economic environment he inherited as well, to an extent. You mentioned Deng there, you know, we saw that it was rapid deregulation because China's still a young economy going through this kind of huge transformation when it comes to growth, to urbanize the entire country, to lift, you know, a billion people or whatever, nearly a billion people out of poverty. That requires almost a growth at all costs mentality at that point. And like you said, much more capitalistic in nature. And then Xi comes in, and like you said, it's this centralizing of power. And we've talked about this, but I think the interesting, you know, the most almost too on the nose symbolically is that shift from city power from the south back to Beijing. Maybe you want to touch on that briefly.
Right. And so again, I think all this comes back down to what the leader, what his ideals are. You know, I from everything that he has done, I think. And actually, he probably said this himself too, that he felt like the party lost control of the direction that the country is moving towards, where he feels that it is very much just capitalism. It's all about, which then has a lot of Western influence into it. And his ideology is it should go back to the roots, you know, of what the founding party represented in China. Now, funny thing though is, you know, I think he didn't just try, he did it. And this is what it caused all these issues that we saw over the past few years, you know, the significant economic slowdown, all this problems arising within the real estate with many of the youth unable to find work these days. And you have a massive outflow of capital within the country. So we're now at a cross point where I think, will he continue? I mean, the question is really, will he continue to go down that path that he started, or is he going to make a pivot, you know, to try and essentially bring China back in alignment with what has happened over the past 4 or 5 decades? You know, from what we can tell at the moment, I think he has made a pivot, you know, where he you know, look at what everything that he's done. He's gone on roadshows to Europe. He has opened up sectors that were historically only controlled by the state. He has asked all his deputy ministers and senior officials within the government to host foreign dignitaries as well as foreign business people. He has made reforms to capital controls, you know, where it seems like he has realigned himself or essentially the country back towards what has happened over the past, you know, decades. But the question though is, well, would this continue? And essentially, what sectors or what businesses will really benefit from this? Because I think historically, there's been, you know, this big push, again, like I said, of just making sure that China can catch up on the information edge, on sort of the, you know, hence the whole push, you know, on connectivity. What will be that sort of theme or that trend going forward, I think, is something we'll all try to figure out. I mean, we have a view. I have a view around this, and you know, I think that's probably the bigger question.
Let's bring it back to markets briefly. We talked about obviously the crackdown, all this anti-monopolistic, the government trying to regulate activities that were monopolistic in nature. Obviously, this hurts the tech companies. But then we go into 2020, and again, to make a comparison with the United States, the US tech companies have enjoyed an almost unparalleled run since 2020. I mean, the Nasdaq's up, you know, probably doubled in that time, if not more. If we look at the Chinese, the main Chinese players on that stock chart, with the exception maybe of Pinduoduo, which we can come to separately, they've all suffered dramatically. Now, obviously, during that time period, we have zero COVID, which has been damaging. But actually, the US tech companies benefited from people being locked inside because they had to, you know, advertising dollars flowed because the eyeballs were forced to look at screens for longer than they did before. What happened in China that we've seen such continued depression in tech companies' pricing? Do you think that is still the hangover from the initial crackdown in 2021? Or do you think this is simply the tech companies now being re-rated, as in they are going to trade lower for longer?
Yeah. So it's interesting you brought up this point, Hugo, because if you look at the tech, the traditional, the well-known internet players in China, between the year 2000 all the way up to 2020, at the end of 2020, they actually outperformed Nasdaq in terms of performance. That's how much they have gained. It's only after 2020 where you see this huge derating that took place. What are the drivers of that? I think there are a few things happening here. Yes, I think the crackdown plays a major role, if not it is the dominant factor, where it essentially dampened their growth. But with that said, fundamentally too, these businesses, if you're just looking at the business, it's actually still quite healthy. If anything, they you know, if you take away, you know, you look at Baba as an example, you know, is cloud business is still growing in double-digit mid-teens. Its international business has actually gone up 40-50% relative to a year ago. GMV is growing again, you know, for e-commerce business. So if you strip out the name Alibaba and you look at these, just these metrics, you actually will find it to be extremely attractive, you know, as a investment. Once you tag on the name Baba on it, then everything changes. So yes, the crackdown was the major driver, the overhang, which actually eroded a lot of the investor confidence when investing in China. But here, I think it's also it warrants a probably a separate conversation as well. Because I think if you look at over the past 20, 30 years, all foreign capital, when they piled into the industry, into the country, were concentrated also in these names. But there are actually so many other businesses that have gone up even more than, let's say, the Tencent or the Baba, the Baidu, the NetEase, in terms of performance, and fundamentally a lot stronger. But they are no one would know about them. And I mean, one name within our portfolio that you probably have heard me talk a lot about was a dealership that sells luxury car. I mean, it's gone up 20 times in the span, more than 20 times in the span of less than five years. You know, so, but again, no one has invested in this name before. So I think this derating, yes, you have this overhang. At the same time, you also have investors that just not used to exploring outside of the investment universe that they have been investing in over the past 20 years. Like, they are not used to looking at other sectors, other industries, because frankly speaking, that requires a lot more due diligence, that requires a lot more expertise, and rightfully so, because, you know, it is an emerging market. It's a huge country, so, you know, 30 different provinces and different demographics and so on and so forth. So you need a lot more resources to do that relative to just buying the benchmark heavy names, which are the internet players. I think just global investors hasn't been used to seeing opportunities outside of this pocket. So when the government cracked down, that confidence completely eroded, and you see this massive exodus, so to speak, of people pulling out, where they essentially even threw out the baby to get out of the bathwater, so to speak. So I also think it's not, yes, the crackdown played a major role, but it's also the fact that global investors their investment on China or their understanding of China had always just been these few players instead of the fuller spectrum of opportunities that are available.
So let's zoom out on like we talked about. These are the best known names, certainly to Western investors. It's the only names most of them know in China, is your Baba, your Tencent, maybe your Baidu, JD.com, perhaps. Let's zoom out and look at the sector as a whole, technology sector as a whole, which for a long time has been funded heavily, as it is in the US, by venture capital and a huge amount of money flowing with zero interest rates into this sector because of the kind of explosive growth that has historically been on offer. I know that private equity were also a key part of that in China, less so probably in the Western economies. Is that continuing, or has that changed dramatically in China since COVID?
I believe that's changed. I mean, you look at the VCP capital, I was actually just talking about this afternoon with a lawyer that specialized, or before he's, you know, specialized in helping private equity do deals. And he said flows just dried up. You know, you have funds that wanted to raise money. They aren't able to because of all the overhangs, because of all the, you know, disinterest within the country. You have funds that raised money prior to all the crackdown that just aren't able to deploy because there aren't any, you know, good sort of, or there aren't any sexy type of deals to invest in. And then you also have all the other ones in between where they are finding it extremely difficult to exit, because the IPO market hasn't been very conducive of that. So private capital into the tech space in general in China is increasingly challenging. Interestingly, because tech is huge, is a huge sector. Internet, social media is only perhaps one aspect of it. Then you also have the hardware side. You know, you have the semiconductor, which the rise of AI ought to have created a lot of interest in this, and it has. The only problem is a lot of the businesses, let's say in the hardware space, in semiconductor, they are funded or supported by the government, which may not be so welcoming of private capital, because of national security, to put it simply. You look at the space race, within China, is actually accelerating. In fact, I think this is one area that just has been flying under the radar and media investors haven't really paid too much attention to. I don't know if you know this, but the International Space Station is scheduled to be decommissioned in about 7 years, by 2031. When that happens, there will only be one space station in orbit, and that is the Chinese Tiangong space station. If you look at some of the hard tech, I remember reading about this, something called responsive launches. China is actually already ahead of the US in being able to deploy rockets much faster without the complicated, infrastructure that supports the launch into space. They're able to replace satellites much faster than the West. They have already equipped Chinese satellites with robotic arms that can essentially, repair other satellites as well. This is stuff that the West are now investing heavily to try to catch up on. This space, unfortunately, is closed off, as you can imagine why, to private capital. Unlike the West, where you have the Blue Origin from Amazon, you have the SpaceX from Elon Musk, where they're essentially funded by the private sector. In China, these are all funded by the state, where even if you want to invest in it, it's impossible. They just won't allow you to play. So I just think that. And this actually ties back to a point that I made earlier on, what will drive tech in China going forward. I think we have seen the private sector driving tech going forward over the past, 20, 30 years. My view is it will be the state that's driving tech, which doesn't mean that they will lag to the rest of the world in any way. In fact, it could very well be much more productive and efficient because you have basically the whole country, the government, pooling capital to make this happen. But from an investment perspective, it is likely going to be shut off, or the opportunity set that will be allowed for private capital to partake in. I think you're going to see that investment universe shrink significantly compared to what we have seen over the past 20, 30 years.
And it's a huge shift in dynamics. Do you think it's fair if we sum that up as for 20 years you had bottom-up driven by the private sector, bottom-up style innovation, and now you have a unique style of top-down innovation that's going to be driven by the government and is going to be far more selective when it comes to sectors? And I think that's,
maybe a fairer classification would be the past, two, three decades is a hybrid of top-down and bottom-up, because, the top-down comes from the infrastructure, like the 5G, the connectivity, that was all the government. But then the bottom up then really come from the applications of it all, the development of all these internet players. Going forward, I think it's going to be top down mostly, where you're going to have the government driving the application as well as the infrastructure for tech.
And would you say that when it comes to markets, it always has paid historically? There's probably a premium when you have a government tailwind as a sector.
Only over the short term.
Yeah.
Only over the short term. I mean, you look at the renewable sector. I think that's probably the best example of this. You know, solar panels were subsidized heavily in 10 years ago. So, I mean, the renewable isn't something new, so to speak, in China. I mean, if you recall, that used to be a company called Henergy. Henergy, the founder, was at one point the richest man in China. Henergy makes solar panels, essentially. It's completely subsidized by the government, and then it went bust. So I would say if there is a big structural tailwind directed by the government, just given the nature of capital flows in China, that it really isn't free flowing, you're gonna see a massive amount of sort of retail type of capital flooding into the public markets in those sectors because they feel like the government is supporting it. But equally quick they go in, they will be equally quick to come out. So I you're right. I think over the short term, yes, you're gonna see this massive premium over a state-supported sector. But once you drag that out a little bit longer, I mean, we have yet seen a sector that actually survive or does really well over the long term that is completely state-controlled.
Yeah. No, it's a really interesting dynamic, I think.
In the public market space.
Yes. Yeah.
For stocks.
Yeah.
If it's not listed, then I mean, yeah. I mean, it's fine. Like, you know, look at the telecoms, look at the banking. I mean, these are all functioning well, yeah. And like I said, they are world leading in a sense. But from a public market perspective, it hasn't really done anything.
Yeah. So it sounds to me like you're perhaps arguing again. Correct me if I'm wrong. That the next is, you know, I think we're officially, I don't want to jinx it, but it feels like officially back in a bull market, 20% rise, I think, in the Hang Seng, at least in the last month or two, maybe year to date, it's about 18, 19 as of recording. If we are in another kind of upswing for China, this type of market environment, you think will look different. It'll be more selective. The winners will be more select within the market more broadly. It feels like historically, in those upswings, you could have bought quite a broad base of companies and probably done very well. You think this might be different in that because of how the government is deploying capital, because of the dry up in VC and PE funding, because of some of the stresses in the private sector, the property sector, this is going to require a kind of a precise hand to pick winners.
Correct. I think especially over the medium to long term, you know, you will start to see winners and companies that go up multiple times within industries that perhaps traditionally were overlooked or less focused upon. The reason why I opened with medium to long term is because I think over the short term, unfortunately, I think people still only know these large, well-known names. So when people do start to invest back into the country, I think they will still pile up into, you know, the Baba, the Tencent, the Baidu, and so on and so forth, especially given the fact that, you know, the index is still heavily weighted towards these names. But my view is that over time, people will start to realize these are no longer the same companies, that they are not going to be generating the kind of return that they had over the past 20, 30 years. You know, in fact, I actually think in some ways, investors are already catching up to this. You know, if you look at the conversations around these names, you know, these days are no longer so much about growth trajectory or how sustainable or how much growth they can come. But it's really all about unlocking shareholder value, about buybacks. How are they going to deploy all these free cash flows that they have generated? How are they going to, you know, should they be issuing more dividends? You know, which
it
is
sounds actually, it sounds just like an American company of an Apple symbol to me.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really, you know, even the investors today, I think increasingly are recognizing that these are will behave more like a mature business than sort of the startup business that they have been. So yes, over the short term, I think it's likely that they will continue to be the darlings, you know, of the global investment community. But over the medium to long term, I think people will start to realize that there's just so many other opportunities out there that will generate the kind of returns that these guys did over the past 30 years.
Maybe let's finish by talking about AI. I think another reason that the US stocks obviously have done so well, certainly from 2023, was that they had this big AI tailwind, and NVIDIA results were yesterday, more strong results, kind of incredible to see that rise. That phenomenon hasn't really bailed out the tech companies in China to any extent. I think the AI scene looks very different. It will always look different. I heard a good one that people are saying instead of ChatGPT in China, it's ChatGBT. Maybe you could talk to us about and I think it's symbolic in terms of how AI will be played, which is via the state. Could you maybe talk to us quickly about your view on AI in China, the future of that, whether that's going to be a really profitable extra gear for companies to make money from?
Yeah, so China is world leading in terms of regulation on AI. They have already issued a number of regulatory controls as to how this ought to develop. You look at ERNIE, which is the ChatGPT equivalent launched by Baidu, is allowing free usage on the bot, which really highlights, I think, two things here. One, which is something that I've maintained for a number of years now with investors, is given the current leadership focus and the fact that, you know, control is sort of the dominant theme for the current leadership, it's really hard to see how they will allow AI to develop the way that we are seeing it develop in, let's say, the US or Europe. You know, there are thousands of people employed by the government who just watch WeChat conversations. And WeChat is just a chatting tool. So, you know, you can imagine just the control and the concern that the government may have over AI development within China, which means they will have a very heavy-handed oversight over this industry, which then really defeats the whole purpose of sort of how we understand AI, so to speak. The second aspect as to why I brought up the idea of, you know, allowing users to freely use ERNIE, is also competition in China is extremely fierce. So there are a number of companies that are also, you know, in some ways, because of the fact that the government is dictating, sort of, you know, sort of setting this framework on the development of AI, everybody is playing within the same pool. So because of that, everybody's competing within the same pool. And when that happens, then, well, it's very, very difficult also for any applications to become profit-driven, because everyone is fighting within the same, you know, everyone is essentially trying to gain the same pie. And you know, if one person starts charging money for their usage, someone else can quickly replicate whatever that player is doing and give it out for free. and then they will probably gobble up all the users. So this heavy-handed regulatory oversight that it has on the industry is also having quite a negative effect on the overall development for businesses, because everyone is, because of the fact that they ring fence the development, everyone is kind of just fighting within the walls, which increase competition and it makes it very difficult as a public investor to invest, because, well, no one again is making any money, and you on top of that, you have this overhang from the government, so you don't even know what will happen over time.
Is there an argument to be made that actually in China, something like AI will the benefits of that will accrue far more or more so to the public companies versus in the private sector? I think if you can make the argument that, and I've read this recently from Dan Wang, which we can put in the show notes, fantastic writer on China, great letters. He was arguing that China will probably have an edge in the implementation of AI because they've set out these strict parameters already. And his idea is that the capital allocation will be much more efficient in the medium term, and you will see AI being implemented in more productive sectors to increase already productive companies or businesses or sectors or however you want to define that, which could actually, and again, those will largely be public companies. So as a profitability measure, people making cash from raising money for AI startups, that ecosystem probably won't exist. But he argues that if you look at the public companies and a higher level, China could actually see quite a lot of, for an already very productive economy, it could see further gains there. Your thoughts on that?
I agree. But the way that I look at it is, it's not so much going to be accrued from sort of the applications that from the AI applications, the companies themselves. And inevitably, many of these will go public at some point. But really from the end user that adapting these applications. So within the public space, those businesses that are quickly adapting whatever AI tools are out there to help them boost efficiency, yes, they will benefit a lot from this, especially given how significant competitions will become. There's so many, there are going to be a lot of alternatives that they can choose from. So my thing is it will accrue to many businesses. It doesn't really matter if it's public or private, but that gain, in my opinion, won't be for the application providers, because a lot of them, I think, are going to be loss making and burning cash for quite a long time. But then whoever that uses whatever tools they provide, I think will be able to benefit much from this. But because of, again, of the fact that it is tightly controlled and kind of ring-fenced, inevitably, I do believe that area in China in terms of AI usage will accelerate faster than the equivalent area of AI usage in the rest of the world. Very similar to space, a couple of minutes ago where I talked about, where, the government is directing capital and research and, execution on certain area of space technology, that is likely going to accelerate much faster than the West.
Yeah, and a final point, I think the government line on the Ant IPO being shelved was, and particularly some of the monopolistic practices, was the idea of disorderly capital. They said, we do not want disorderly capital. And what you've just described to me there, and I think it's a nice note to finish on, is we are seeing that transformation is now complete and will continue from what you said to me, from disorderly capital to more orderly capital, where you have this top-down guidance, the parameters are set, and within those parameters, there is obviously room for profitability, room for companies to flourish, but there will be walls on either side, effectively.
Correct.
Stephen, thank you very much. Always love having you on, a ton of insights, and hopefully we'll speak to you again soon.
Always a pleasure, Hugo. Looking forward to the next podcast.
Thank you, Stephen.
Let's quickly summarize the most interesting points from our conversation with Stephen. Point one. In the near term, top-down factors still drive Chinese tech stocks. In short, the government's growth priorities are far more predictive of the sector's winners than fundamentals. Point two. The supposedly temporary dislocations caused by the 2021 tech crackdown now feel closer to a derating of the mega-cap giants, that includes Baba, Tencent and Baidu, as the government keeps pressure on the sector. Point three. Power has shifted from the tech hubs of Shanghai and Shenzhen back to Beijing, and with it, capital flows. The traditional funding of technology businesses by PE and VC has been decimated and the government has stepped in to fill that role. As such, the capital now comes with caveats, as it is funneled into more productive sectors, including semiconductors, battery technology, smart manufacturing, and the space race. A state-sponsored innovation model will offer more dispersed investment opportunities, which favors an active stock-picking approach. And finally, AI development and investment is clearly gathering pace in China, but it remains more ChatGPT rather than GPT. The priority will remain government control and consumer protection over profiteering, and thus winners will likely be in productivity increases for end users versus application builders and platform owners. Thank you for listening to this latest podcast from Erebus Presents. If you enjoyed what you heard, please like and subscribe as it helps others to find us. Erebus Capital Limited is a fund distribution and marketing firm based in London. For more information, please visit us at erebuscapital.com.
This recording has been prepared by Erebus Capital Limited, hereafter referred to as Erebus, for entertainment and information purposes only, and is intended solely for professional investors only and not retail clients. The information, views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not constitute investment advice, an offer to buy or sell any securities, or an endorsement to make or consider any investment or course of action. You should consult a professional before making any investment decisions. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. Investments can go down as well as up. The information provided is believed to be valid and accurate on the date it is first published. Erebus does not accept any liability for any loss arising from the use of the information. Any expressions of opinions reflect the views of the speakers and not necessarily those of Erebus, and are subject to change without notice. This recording is the property of Erebus and is not to be reproduced in whole or in part without prior written consent.